Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Dagena Dor, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Joshua Esler about his new book, Tibetan Buddhism Among Han Chinese, Mediation and Superscription of the Tibetan Tradition in Contemporary Chinese Society, published by Lexington Books in 2020. Dr. Esler, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on the show. Yeah, thank you.
Great. I wonder if you begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in East Asian studies and Buddhist studies.
Yeah, so originally I'm from Australia, but I was born in Bangladesh. Then I lived in different parts of Asia and also the Middle East. So I've always been interested in Asian studies in general. So I studied my PhD in Asian studies at the University of Western Australia. Specifically in the Department of Chinese Studies. And the particular focus of my PhD was on the topic of the adaptation of Tibetan Buddhism to wider Chinese society. So at present, I'm working as a lecturer at Sheridan Institute of Higher Education in Perth, Western Australia. And the areas I'm teaching are Asian studies, history, and sociology.
Thank you. We don't really get a lot of scholars from Australia, so it's really exciting to have you.
Especially Western Australia, maybe. We are right on the most isolated city in the world, in Perth.
Yeah, that's true. So it's really great to have you.
Thank you.
So I guess before we dig into your fantastic book, can you please tell us about how you came to write this monograph, right, Tibetan Buddhism on Han Chinese, and maybe a little bit how you managed to get more than 80 interviews through your ethnographic work?
Yeah, so I've always been interested in Tibetan culture and language. So this interest began when I was a child. I used to visit Nepal with my family on holiday there. And of course, in Nepal, there's a big Tibetan refugee community. So I was always fascinated as a child to hear the chanting in the monasteries and to see the monks there. So I was fascinated with Tibetan culture, and this became more entrenched as I grew older. At university, I was able to study, I wasn't able to study really anything about Tibet in my undergraduate course, as we don't have a Tibetan studies program here in West Australia. But during my PhD, I was able, under Asian studies, to within the Chinese department, to study this topic on how Tibetan Buddhism is spreading among Han Chinese people. Yeah, so that's how my interest grew. And I met my interlocutors through a variety of different ways in each location. So my field work was carried out as I said in the book, in Beijing, Gyeongtang, in Deqing, Tibetan Autonomous Prefecture, Hong Kong, and Taipei in Taiwan. So the interlocutors were lamas and Tibetan lamas and monks, and also Chinese and other minority practitioners and lay Tibetans. So in Taipei and Hong Kong, it was quite straightforward to engage with interlocutors. I just called up basically all of the Tibetan centers in these two locations and asked the Head Lama if I could speak with him and some of his Chinese followers. So in Hong Kong and Taiwan, it's very straightforward, but in Beijing and Geltang, usually I would meet a handful of interlocutors and then they would introduce me to their wider networks, and it grew from there. So kind of snowballed on the mainland. So it's more, had to be a bit more careful to how I met interlocutors on the mainland. But slowly once you meet people, then they have their own networks and you get introduced to other people.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really impressive, the number of diverse voices and narratives that you're able to collect in the book. So your book opens with a perceptive observation on Tibetan Buddhism in contemporary China, that it's facing ongoing restrictions and challenges imposed by the state, but also at the same time, it has now entered mainstream Chinese society with a growing middle class and even celebrity following. So can you tell us briefly first, how has Tibetan Buddhism become mainstream amongst the middle class Chinese people despite state restrictions?
Yeah, so I found that Tibetan Buddhism in its home environment in the Tibetan Autonomous Region and certain other Tibetan Autonomous Prefectures is under restrictions and surveillance, particularly within Gelug monasteries. So this is explored quite thoroughly in John Power's book, The Buddha Party. Even at Larungar Buddhist Institute in Sichuan Province now, this institute that previously enjoyed more freedoms is now under more restrictions and surveillance as well. But in wider China, on the other hand, we see Tibetan Buddhism has a lot more freedom in many ways. And I think this is because Tibetan Buddhism within Chinese societies has become more individuated rather than a type of collectivist practice, especially in mainland China. And I think there's some similarities here with how it's become individuated also in the West in certain circles. So Chinese practitioners, they can practice at home or in any secluded place that they choose without anyone even knowing they are Tibetan Buddhists. So even some party officials, for example, they apparently can practice in secret in their own homes. They have their own private altar in their home and they can meditate without and carry out rituals without anyone knowing that they are doing this. So, and as Dan Yu points out, the practice of, for example, Dzogchen from the Nyingma school is particularly popular in mainland China, given that it's this type of individuated practice. So, and also if you, as long as one is following a Tibetan Lama who is not blacklisted by the state and who has the right political affiliations, there should be no problem for Chinese practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism. Further, also the high-profile celebrities who are now following Tibetan Lamas, this also gives these Lamas a further kind of red stamp of approval in addition to state approval, because they have their own celebrity status, and that kind of keeps them safe as well. Also the government census that goes out, which asks Chinese citizens their religious affiliation, doesn't tend to differentiate between Chinese and Tibetan Buddhists among Han Chinese citizens. So you can tick the box as being a Buddhist without saying you are Tibetan Buddhist, which also helps them keep a low profile. So the state may be worried about Chinese following so-called separatist lamas, on the other hand, or lamas who give teachings in private homes in eastern China. But it seems according to the Chinese constitution, there's really nothing which states that this is illegal practice. So, by and large, they're not really an underground group. They fit a more gray area, not really being having the red stamp of approval, but not being blacklisted as well. So within that kind of gray area, they're more free to practice their faith and to kind of negotiate restrictions.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, this is definitely a very understudied area that you're highlighting in this book. And an important idea you introduce early on in the book to explain the popularization of Tibetan Buddhism in contemporary China is the idea of mandalization, how the Tibetan Buddhist clergy have found ways to work within Chinese restrictions in their effort to re-mandalize not only Tibetan cultural regions, but also areas outside of geographic Tibet. Can you tell us more about this idea of re-mandalization?
Yeah, so this idea is actually taken from Charlene Mackley's work, in which she explores how the Tibetan religious elite negotiating their place within Greater China. So, of course, a mandala is this concentric circles of power surrounding a central deity who is visualized in Tibetan Buddhist initiation rites. Of course, yeah, the land of Tibet itself is considered to be a giant mandala with important monasteries and retinues of beings sitting at key points throughout this landscape, with the locus of spiritual power and temporal power being in the hands of reincarnate lamas. So in post-1950 and especially post-1959 Tibet, the temporal aspect of this power has largely been replaced with Chinese state power. But during the reform and opening period of the 1980s, especially monasteries began to be reestablished, and we have reincarnate lamas who were key to this reconstruction and resurrection of Tibetan Buddhism after the Cultural Revolution. So in 1981, Jigme Punso established the Larungar Buddhist Institute in Sotar in Sichuan province. And this has been a really influential center for the spread of Tibetan Buddhism among Chinese disciples to this day. So this is a good example of what I term following Mackley's use, the remantalization of not only Tibetan cultural regions, but also outside geographic Tibet. So Jigme Punsog and other subsequent Tibetan masters from Larungar, they have visited sacred sites outside Tibet proper, located in the Chinese landscape, such as Wu Tai Shan. And we could see these visits and recruitment of Chinese disciples as a kind of continuation of the activities of Tibetan Buddhist masters in the past, who did the same thing, yeah, by widening the kind of symbolic mandalic spheres of spiritual power beyond Tibet itself. And so as they expand this spiritual power to regions beyond Tibet, a Tibetan worldview centered around these kind of giants of the faith is being adopted to an extent among Chinese practitioners. So as I mentioned in the introduction to the book, these practitioners, although they are separated from their spiritual masters and often from each other as well by geographic distance throughout China, they take part in a type of shared imagined community. So they partake in the same rituals, they chant in the same sacred languages, they follow similar masters, they aspire to the bodhisattva ideal of giving self for others and wishing happiness and freedom from suffering for others as for themselves. And so this worldview stands in stark contrast to the materialist world worldview around them that is perceived to be the antithesis to all of this. So of course, this remandalization, which is mediated through these Tibetan masters, is not a straightforward process in mainland China, given state restrictions and surveillance. It's rather a process of negotiating ways through these restrictions to influence these disciples beyond the geographic space of Tibet. So of course, in the West, this process has been much more straightforward, with few, if any, government restrictions to curtail the spread of Tibetan Buddhism there. So this is what I meant by, yeah, mandalizing beyond the Tibetan geographic sphere.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. And in chapter one, it's also argued that Tibetan Buddhism actually offers an alternative worldview, right? In addition to this alternative, I guess, imagine a community geographical landscape that you argue, an alternative worldview to Han China's religious life. So what is Tibetan Buddhism's answers to the so-called China spiritual crisis, quote unquote, a phenomenon that has been sort of pointed out by quite a few scholars recently?
Yeah, so many of the Chinese interlocutors I met, they saw Tibetan Buddhism as really the highest form of spirituality there is. while others saw Chan Buddhism in particular as being on an equal level, although they saw Chan Buddhism as being less accessible given the perceived lack of genuine Chinese Buddhist masters in contemporary China, and also due to the conversion of Chinese Buddhist monasteries and temples into tourist sites. So Tibetan Buddhism is perceived as being particularly potent, both in regards to its insights and the rituals for solving mundane concerns which it has within its practice. So it kind of fills the vacuum in the Buddhist scene in China with its charismatic reincarnate lamas and their lineages, which are believed to be unbroken since the time of the Buddha and subsequent spiritual giants such as Nagarjuna and Milarepa. So the worldview centered around these unbroken lineages is one based on the bodhisattva aspiration of compassion for all sentient beings, the visualization of every sentient as one's mother in a past life, the visualization of one's enemy as a precious jewel, which should be held dear as one's guru. So all of these ideas are found within a Tibetan Buddhist worldview, and they're seen to stand in stark contrast to the indifference towards and even exploitation of others found in an entirely materialist worldview in contemporary China. So even the Communist Party has initiated various campaigns to reinstill within Chinese citizens Chinese moral values that they are perceived to have lost since modernization. So while this is arguably to maintain national unity and to deter civil unrest, it nevertheless points out that there's a problem with contemporary Chinese materialist society. So the Chinese practitioners I met, they also spoke of Chinese society becoming more selfish, like inward-looking, hedonistic, materialistic, which leads to a wide range of social problems. So they saw Tibetan Buddhism, on the other hand, as offering a kind of compassionate worldview for all sentient beings, led by the Tibetan gurus who have inherited the teachings and incarnation lineages. So in the words of one Chinese interlocutor I spoke with in Beijing, he said that they, the Chinese practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism, want to take this compassionate worldview and to make the rest of China like Tibet. So this was a sentiment shared by many other practitioners I met. So that is not to return to a type of Shangri-La, a type of idealized Tibet, but they want to change society around them from a focus on a false sense of self from which all of these current evils are believed to stem into a society which puts others first and where exploitation and disregard for others in the environment disappears and so forth.
Mm. Yeah, this idea of making China more like Tibet is very fascinating. And a critical observation that you made in the book is that there's also a kind of idealization, right? That's becoming more obvious as we talk now. And also reimagining of Tibet and Tibetan Buddhism amongst Han Chinese practitioners. And that this kind of idealization is not unlike how Tibetan Buddhism is idealized and imagined in the West, right? So what does this tell us about the wider forces of the modern imagining of Tibetan Buddhism?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that Tibetan Buddhism in China is being idealized and imagined in many similar ways to which it has been idealized and imagined in the West. Part of the reason for this is that Tibetan Buddhism has become a global religion. So it has been widely accepted, of course, by Hollywood stars and written extensively upon, especially since the arrival of Tibetan Buddhism in America from the 1970s. So these books written originally in English have been also translated into Chinese. You can go to cafes in Beijing and find the same books translated into Chinese from English. Yeah, further, there are many books originally written by foreigners. So not just Tibetan teachers, by foreigners, which have been translated into Chinese. And some of these foreign writers are converts to Tibetan Buddhism, while others are writing from a type of impressionistic outside perspective. So some of these books portray Tibetan Buddhism, Tibetans, and Tibet in an idealized way, And this appears to have been picked up and adopted by a number of Chinese who read them. Elsewhere, another factor is that Little Tibets, so-called Little Tibets, have appeared in a number of Tibetan areas outside of the Tibetan Autonomous Region, such as Gyaltang or Shangri-La in Deqing, Tibetan Autonomous Prefecture in Yunnan Province, which I explore in Chapter 5 of the book. So these are kind of state and tourist-sponsored sites of imagined Tibets outside Tibet proper, where tourists and variously pilgrims can get a taste of what the real Tibet is apparently like. So specifically, the reconstruction of sites such as Gyaltang as Shangri-La and other places in the Tibetan landscape as Shambhala, for example, this has no doubt gone some way in popularizing Tibet, Tibetans and their faith in an idealized way in China. To add to this imaginative process, local Chinese writers, whether practitioners or not, they're also writing personal accounts of their own spiritual epiphanies in the Tibetan landscape. So these accounts are often told in idealistic terms, in language that is reminiscent of Western colonial language used in relation to the places they colonized, of taming the landscape or being tamed themselves by its mysterious appeal. At the same time, I argue that this idealization of Tibetan Buddhism is not an entirely external phenomena being adopted by Chinese. Tibetan reincarnate lamas are similarly perceived by lay Tibetans to be spiritual giants of meditation and philosophy who have attained high levels of realization as well as accompanying supernormal powers. So the Tibetan landscape as well is also believed to be sacred within a Tibetan Buddhist worldview, not just among Western and Chinese enthusiasts of Tibet. So if one is sick, for example, you can ingest the sacred soil of Tibet, which is believed to have healing properties. And Tibet is perceived to be a holy land among Tibetans, and Tibetans type of a kind of chosen people, in much the same way as Jews perceive Israel to be a holy land and their own people as being chosen. So in that sense, an apparently idealized vision of Tibet, Tibetans and Tibetan Buddhism is not really entirely external and unique to this vision already found within Tibetan Buddhist worldview. So yeah, further I argue that the way in which Chinese practitioners see Tibet, Tibetans and Tibetan Buddhism stands in stark contrast to the way in which they have been traditionally portrayed in state propaganda accounts from the 1950s to the 1980s. And even these accounts even continue to some extent today. These accounts in the propaganda portray Tibetans as being backward, dirty, lazy, superstitious, and even animalistic. In contrast, upon meeting real Tibetans in their home environment, many Chinese practitioners I spoke with noted how different they were to how they were portrayed in state propaganda. So rather than being put backward, these practitioners interpreted Tibetan supposed backwardness with the actual lack of concern for material things because they have the Dharma for which they will sell their own houses and properties even to go on pilgrimage. So what is termed as superstition by state propaganda, these practitioners see as the ultimate level of spiritual attainment and so forth. So they kind of, there's this type of reverse acculturation happening where these practitioners attribute to Tibetans and Tibetan Buddhism spiritual layers of meaning that override these negative images propagated by the state. And it's also this contrasting foreignness of the Tibetan landscape in contrast to urban Chinese areas and the apparent differences between Tibetans and Han Chinese and between Tibetan Buddhism and Chinese religions that attracts a number of Chinese practitioners to follow Tibetan Buddhism in the first place. So this kind of foreign difference that makes it stand out in contrast to wider China. So in short, the idealization of Tibetan Buddhism, its people and its landscape in China among Chinese practitioners, it comes from many directions, both externally from the West and internally within Chinese society itself.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Wow, thank you for this really detailed analysis. And let's go into the exciting chapters of the book. So first of all, chapter 2 of the book offers a very intriguing discussion on the incorporation of Guan Gong or Guan Yu, or the Chinese god of war, into the Karmakagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism. Here you're engaging with Prasenjit Durara's idea of superscription to show us how this Chinese deity has been reinterpreted. Can you tell us more about this idea of superscription and the interpretation of new religious meanings across cultural boundaries?
Yeah, so Guan Gong is, as outlined in chapter 2, he's a kind of a ubiquitous figure in the Chinese world, as well as in Tibetan and Mongolian contexts at various junctures in history. Yeah, he has often been called the Chinese god of war, but he's in fact much more than that. He's also, so as you said, based on the historical figure Guan Yu, a commander from the late Eastern Han Dynasty period. And in his post-mortem state, as an anthropomorphic god, he's been considered a god of wealth, a god of protection and literature, protector of Chinese Buddhist temples, and also the main god sometimes of some Taoist temples, as well as a popular martial arts figure in contemporary Chinese novels. In Hong Kong today, he's the patron of both triads and police in Hong Kong, which is quite ironic today. Yeah, so he has been superscribed with so many different meanings, as I outlined in chapter 2. So he was given ever grander titles by different emperors, and he reached the peak of his godhood during the Qing dynasty when he was given the most illustrious titles. He was also important in Sino-Tibetan borderland areas, where he has, at least in one case, been associated with a local mountain god. He was also important as a protector in Gelug and Karmakagyu schools, and he was incorporated into the Karmakagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism by the fifth Karmapa during the Ming Dynasty. And until recently, he was the protector deity of the 16th Karmapa's Tsurpu Monastery. But after this, the Sadana text was lost, and it wasn't until the current 17th Gyalwang Karmapa had a vision in which Guan Gong appeared to him that he was reincorporated into the Karmakagyu school in 2005 when the Karmapa wrote a new sadhana for him. So there's a lot of interesting layers of meaning that have been layered upon Guan Gong, which have accumulated throughout Chinese history and now in the current Sino-Tibetan context. So I used Juara's idea of superscription to describe this process, whereby this god has been layered with new and sometimes divergent meanings by different parties, even as certain historical continuities continue to exist in parallel with these new layers of meaning. So Guan Gong became the kind of symbolic blueprint for my book. In the same way in which Guan Gong has been superscribed with new meanings, so too has Tibetan Buddhism in Greater China. Tibetan Buddhism among Chinese practitioners is now intersecting with the traditional Chinese cosmology of gods, ghosts, and ancestors, even while it is also intersecting with modernist discourses of the state, and in Hong Kong, a modernist Protestant worldview. and the popular imagining of Tibetan Buddhism, Tibetans and Tibet through a kind of Shangri-La lens as well. So despite these new layers of meaning, many continuities that are present in Tibetan Buddhism in its home environment continue. And I subsequently argue that Tibetan Buddhism itself is not only being superscribed with new meaning, but acts as a medium for reorienting the lives, ideas, and practices of these Chinese practitioners. So it is simultaneously layered with new meaning, but is also a powerful worldview in its own right that serves to direct practitioners in new directions to which they were not previously exposed. So Guangdong became a good analogy for the wider ways in which Tibetan Buddhism is being superscribed, yet is acting as a conduit through which the lives of these practitioners are being changed.
Very interesting. And chapter 3 is on the Confucian revival and Tibetan Buddhism. And here you explain that the CCP has been skillfully using Confucius for its own political ends. So too are certain Han and other ethnic practitioners layering Tibetan Buddhism with the new Confucian superscription. So how compatible is Confucian thought with Tibetan Buddhism according to these diverse interlocutors that you have interviewed?
Yeah, so I found quite a few Chinese practitioners saw Confucianism or Confucian thought as being compatible with Tibetan Buddhism at a mundane type of human level. So that is, they saw both Confucianism and Buddhism as being compatible in that they both promote moral values, ethics, harmonious relationships, and a wider harmonious society. They even saw Confucianism as a kind of entry level into higher Buddhist practices. Many emphasized that Buddhism was established in China historically in conjunction with Confucian thinking, and suggested that Confucian thinking prepared the way for Buddhism because of its emphasis on harmonious human relationships, self-cultivation, and so forth. So it's interesting, they didn't talk about the historical rivalry between Confucianism and Buddhism, or about the jealousy of the Confucian literati concerning the popularity of Tibetan Buddhist lamas during the Ming and Qing dynasties in the imperial court. Instead, positive elements of Confucian-Buddhist interaction were played up and brought forward to the current context of the recent Confucian revival in China. So these interlocutors often spoke of Tibetan Buddhism being able to contribute to a truly harmonious society, a slogan which is used by the CCP since Hu Jintao's era, apparently drawn from Confucian thought. So it's sometimes hard to distinguish the voice of these interlocutors from the state, on the mainland at least, in regard to the relationship between Confucianism and Tibetan Buddhism in the current context. Other practitioners I talked to, on the other hand, they thought that Confucianism and Tibetan Buddhism are not compatible at all. So some even saw Confucianism as a kind of impediment to the practice of Tibetan Buddhism. One interlocutor, he described Confucianism as a kind of a great wall that prevented people from seeing the true nature of the reality of things, with its emphasis on hierarchical human relations and its many rules that bind it at the kind of human level. So this latter group of practitioners were often those who had been traumatized, I found, by difficult life circumstances, such as the loss of a loved one or a difficult divorce. So they wanted to escape these painful experiences in a completely transformative religion, and they found this in Tibetan Buddhism. So they often described Tibetan Buddhism as being beyond the world, while Confucianism was still bound to it. And many of these practitioners were also attracted to the foreignness of Tibetan Buddhism, to something that was so different to everything they were accustomed to in the Chinese world up to that point. So some of these practitioners, they escaped urban centers in eastern China to live in Tibetan areas such as Geltang in Deqing Tibetan Autonomous Prefecture. And some had been to Larungar in Sichuan Province or to other nearby Tibetan areas. So they spoke of their Tibetan masters as being immeasurably wise, having profound insight into the nature of the reality of things, even having supernormal powers and so forth. And so these qualities they could not find in Confucianism. So it's something that was so utterly for these practitioners to Confucianism that made them distinguish, make a sharp distinguish, to sharply distinguish between the two traditions. Yeah.
Thank you for that. And chapter four sort of shifts our focus to Hong Kong. And here the chapter is titled Pragmatism, Protestantism, and Tibetan Buddhism in Hong Kong. Here the chapter explores how Chinese practical religious approaches overlaps with Tibetan Buddhism. So how have Chinese practitioners in Hong Kong have been navigating their beliefs and practices between all these various traditions and practices like Tibetan Buddhism, popular Chinese religions, materialism, and also Protestantism?
Yeah, so there's two main groups of practitioners I met in Hong Kong. Some were from a popular Chinese religious background before turning to Tibetan Buddhism, while others were from a Catholic or Protestant background who had been educated within a Christian education system. So both popular religion and especially Protestant Christianity have been particularly influential in Hong Kong. So one Hong Kong scholar has called popular religion in Hong Kong a nameless religion, as it is dispersed in a variety of forms throughout Hong Kong and is not as institutionalized as in other parts of the Chinese world. Of course, you have exceptions with the Chinese temples throughout the territory that belong to a wider institutional group of temples, but in many ways, popular religion in Hong Kong is no longer clan-based, and instead it's a set of practices that different individual families follow. So these practices are therefore usually concerned with propitiating different gods for mundane requests, such as wealth increase, success in studies, familial harmony, and so forth. So I found that many practitioners who came to Tibetan Buddhism from a popular Chinese religious background, they often carried across similar mundane concerns into the practice of Tibetan Buddhism and would request different rituals from their Tibetan teachers to solve these problems. So Tibetan Buddhism, of course, does provide for the fulfillment of mundane requests, although the Tibetan teachers I met, they always emphasize that one's intentions are very important. So you can't just pray to Tsambala, the Tibetan god of wealth, for example, and then strike rich. Your intentions have and karmic history will influence the outcome. Yeah, so one lama in Hong Kong, he told me that Chinese practitioners come to him with these requests to get rich or solve other mundane problems, and that they have this kind of mentality of incense and results. So they put their incense out in the evening, expect the problem to be solved in the morning. So this is what I heard from many other Tibetan lamas. They found that some Chinese practitioners, they want immediate results and don't properly understand theories concerning karma. On top of popular Chinese religion, yeah, materialism has a strong presence in Hong Kong. So the former colony was built by merchants and up until recently has been a major entrepot for trade and commerce. So many Hong Kongers invest in the stock market. They enjoy buying designer brands. They look up to entrepreneurs such as Li Ka-shing as the peak of success. So I don't want to suggest, as some have suggested, that Hong Kongers are addicted to material fetishism, as this would be a sweeping generalization. But in very broadly in general, materialist ideals are strongly rooted in the territory, and there is some qualitative research that backs this up. So I found that the overlapping interests in popular religious practices and this materialism has led some practitioners to approach Tibetan Buddhism for mundane concerns as much as they approach it for soteriological ends. Other practitioners, however, were from a Protestant or Catholic background or had been educated in a Protestant or Catholic school. So they often looked upon this popular Chinese religion as superstitious. And they believed that propitiating Buddhas and Bodhisattvas for material and other mundane requests were antithetical to Buddhism. So they variously saw the rituals of Tibetan Buddhism for mundane requests as cultural accretions that have been added to Tibetan Buddhism in a Tibetan home environment that have distorted the original message of Buddhism. So while they saw these rituals as a wise use of kind of skillful means to help Tibetans follow Tibetan lamas and benefit more widely from the actual message of Buddhism, they didn't request mundane things from the root lamas themselves, as they didn't believe in the efficacy of these rituals. So instead, these practitioners, they saw meditation as the core concern of Tibetan Buddhism, yeah, in much the same way that many Westerners see and interpret Tibetan Buddhism. So these practitioners often frequent meditation centers in Hong Kong that are less traditional and more modern, and they also follow teachers such as Mingo Rinpoche, who offer a more universalistic and less kind of Tibetan traditional presentation of Tibetan Buddhism. So one practitioner from a Protestant background, for example, she found that the traditional Tibetan Buddhist centers in Hong Kong were scary, in her words. So while she felt at home and learned a lot more in Mingo Rinpoche's Turga Center in Hong Kong and at his talks. So practitioners from a popular religious background, on the other hand, were attracted to these more traditional centers and to the rituals offered there for mundane concerns. So there's quite a contrast that I found between the practitioners from a popular religious or Christianized background in Hong Kong.
This is very fascinating findings. And chapter 5 shifts our focus to the Deqing, Tibetan Autonomous Prefecture in the Yunnan province in mainland China, and draws our attention to the sacred Buddhist landscape of the area, which has been a location for environmentalist actions and ecotourism. So how has this Tibetan region and the sacred landscape been reinterpreted and reimagined through these very different modern discourses of environmentalism?
Yes, so Deqing Tibetan Autonomous Prefecture, so after 2001 in particular, became an important site of conservation and ecotourism. And this followed a ban on logging after the floods in 1998 when the Yangtze River was breached. So, yeah, the local authorities have changed the name of the prefecture to Shangri-La, and the main town, Geltang, has also now bears the same name as the prefecture. So the prefecture has since this time, since 2001, attracted many Chinese and quite a few overseas visitors as well. Yeah, the site of Kawakarpo mountain range, one of the eight abode mountains of Tibetan pilgrimage, has become particularly popular for tourists as well as pilgrims. And so Kawakarpo is one of a retinue of mountain gods believed to inhabit the landscape in the area. And pilgrimage to this site is very important for Tibetans. So this Tibetan belief in the sacredness of the landscape and the myriad beings that inhabit this landscape is termed geopiety by Chris Coggins, and in his and Emily Ye's work on this region. So a geopious worldview maintains that deities and spirits inhabit the landscape, and they're able to protect it and bring consequences upon those who seek to damage this landscape or commit socially unacceptable acts within the human community in the vicinity of these deities and spirits. So the new environmentalist discourse that is currently popular in the prefecture and more widely in other parts of China, on the other hand, maintains that people are in control of preservation of the landscape. So while a geopious worldview maintains that there is interconnectivity between deities and spirits and people, and that their continued existence is mutually dependent, a Western environmentalist view is more anthropocentric. So it's more of a one-way relationship. So in chapter 5, I wanted to explore how different Chinese and Tibetan practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism interpret the place of mountain deity cults, which have been Buddhicized to a large extent within or against this environmentalist discourse. So what I found to my surprise was that many Chinese practitioners believe that Tibetan deities and spirits exist, and some believe that disturbing their abodes would result in retribution. So for example, one Chinese practitioner I met in Geltang believed that the Sino-Japanese team, there's a Sino-Japanese climbing team, that had climbed Mount Kawakalpo in 1991. They had perished because they had offended the resident deity by climbing the mountain. She also believed that Tibetans who had made pilgrimage around Kawakalpo prior to the 2010 Yushu earthquake had been spared during the earthquake. So she really believes in the power of this deity to protect and to also take retribution out on those who kind of flaunt the geopious rules surrounding this mountain. Yes, she also makes pilgrimage to the mountain herself. And she said she feels the presence of Kawakalpo and believes in his protection. She also prays to her root Lama while at the mountain facing Kawakalpo and believes that both her Lama and the mountain god protect and guide her. So for her, the mountain gods and the other land-based beings in the Tibetan landscape, they have their own power and they're not reliant on people for protection. So there's quite a disconnect here between an environmentalist discourse and a Tibetan geopious worldview. But some practitioners, some Tibetan practitioners I met, however, they thought that local mountain gods and other land-based entities may or may not exist. And some were even adamant that they are a figment of the imagination, although belief in them may help to preserve the environment. So that is a good thing. So even among Tibetans themselves, some Tibetans are losing that geopious belief while some Chinese are following it. So it's quite an interesting contrast. However, most Tibetans I spoke to, they saw these beings as real, and some thought that an entirely anthropocentric environmentalist paradigm was somewhat in opposition to their geopious worldview. So a member of the Kawagebo Cultural Society in Dechan, for example, he emphasized that while protecting the environment was important, the local deities and spirits are kind of family for Tibetans, and environmentalism must not override this belief. So in fact, if it does override this belief and a geopious view is no longer maintained by Tibetans, he felt that there would be a kind of disconnect between Tibetans and the environment, and this would lead to apathy for the natural environment. So his society seeks to primarily preserve these geopious beliefs and culture, while a secondary outcome is environmental protection. But it's also interesting, so it's interesting to see how these formerly atheist Chinese now buy into a geopious worldview, even as some Tibetans are leaving it behind. On the other hand, I found that there are also Tibetans who have lived in Chinese areas and have become secularized, but they've recently returned to Deqing, and here they have again taken up a geopious view of the Tibetan landscape. Yeah, so quite a few different things happening in that chapter.
Yeah, this is a particularly interesting, intriguing chapter. Yeah, like you said, it's a very kind of mind-boggling contradiction as well. And chapter six, when we go on, investigates the intersection between Chinese beliefs in ghosts and Tibetan Buddhism. So here you're asking a lot of really interesting and fascinating questions. One of the questions was why ghost culture was still so rooted among these Chinese practitioners, and how Tibetan teachers such as Yonge Mingyur Rinpoche were addressing this issue among their Chinese followers. And in the same chapter, you're also interested in another question and finding out what, if any, impact the CCP's anti-superstition campaigns and rhetorics had on the beliefs of these practitioners concerning ghosts. So tell us what you sort of found by asking these questions in your book.
Yeah, so I found that many practitioners in mainland China, Hong Kong and Taiwan believe that ghosts exist. And the types of ghosts they spoke about were quite often those of the unattended dead, as portrayed in Chinese traditional cosmology as kind of shadows of the self wandering about because descendants haven't attended to their needs in the afterlife. So the ghosts they spoke of were also rather frightening beings. So ghosts of a more strictly Buddhist cosmology are usually preta or hungry ghosts, as has been translated in Chinese. So these ghosts are not a shadow of the self, but they're fully reborn sentients who are located in one of the preta realms, although some of them may move amongst us as well in the human realm. But preta are generally portrayed in Buddhist art as having a kind of bloated stomach, a tiny mouth through which food cannot pass, or the food they touch turns to fire and so forth. So they are kind of pitiful beings that live in constant torment and are not to be feared, but to be pitied. So I found that while many practitioners refer to preta as hungry ghosts, the ghosts they encountered themselves through their personal experiences were more often those of Chinese popular accounts of ghosts. So that is, you know, unattended ghosts that better fit the Chinese cosmology of gods, ghosts, and ancestors. I found that Chinese ghost beliefs are still so prevalent among these practitioners due to their own personal encounters with ghosts. So I also hypothesized that ghost belief in Chinese society or Chinese societies in general is still prevalent because it is not institutionalized. So it doesn't belong to any particular religion. It's dispersed thoroughly throughout popular Chinese religious practice, as well as among those who follow no religion at all, or no religion in particular. So of course, Tibetan Buddhism also has its own retinue of terrifying afterlife characters, such as evil spirits that may animate a dead body as a zombie if appropriate rites are not performed, for example. But Tibetan teachers constantly remind their practitioners not to fear malevolent beings, but to view them with pity as sentient beings like ourselves who wish to be free from suffering. So often they reiterate that such beings appear to test our faith, but if we see them as they really are, that is ultimately non-existent, then we will have conquered them. So many modernist Tibetan Buddhist teachers who have taught in the West, they often downplay the existence of such beings altogether, as they know perhaps that a traditional account of Tibetan Buddhism may not be received as well among an apparently rational Western audience. So when these same teachers teach in the Chinese world, they often teach through the same rationalist lens that they would a Western audience. And this appeals to many young modern Chinese practitioners, but there are also quite a large number of traditionalist Chinese practitioners who come to Tibetan Buddhism and who still believe in the existence of ghosts. Yeah, so such teachers as Mingyur Rinpoche, they may not always take into account this traditionalist worldview of gods, ghosts, and ancestors, and therefore elements of their message may stand in contrast to the ideas and views of some of these practitioners. So Mingyur Rinpoche, in his talks in Hong Kong, for example, spoke of the need to move on from a fear of ghosts and that they are ultimately created by our own minds. But many practitioners I met told me about personal encounters they had with ghosts prior to their conversion to Tibetan Buddhism, and that while they know the truth of Buddhism concerning their ultimate non-existence, they still held on to these frightening experiences. On the other hand, I also met Chinese practitioners who referred to ghost beliefs in much the same way as the CCP has in its anti-superstitious campaigns and rhetoric as figments of a fearful imagination. So while these practitioners did not deny their existence entirely, they often emphasized that certain natural phenomena may be mistaken for ghosts, and much in the same way that CCP publications have done. So these practitioners often use the rationalism of party rhetoric in conjunction with modernist Tibetan Buddhist teaching to place ghosts within their own worldview as beings not to be feared. And that more important in the wider scheme of things was overcoming what they call the kind of ghost of one's heart, or xinmo, xingui. So that is this type of delusional thinking concerning existence in general. So of course, the wider Tibetan Buddhist beliefs concerning existence and liberation from cyclic existence differs greatly from CCP rhetoric, but it's interesting how at certain junctures, both the scientific rationalism of the state and their own faith congeal. And it is likely that these Chinese practitioners take this view, at least on the mainland, from their Tibetan teachers, some of whom have written books on the compatibility of Tibetan Buddhism with science and the practicality of Tibetan Buddhism for modern Chinese society, that it's not an idealistic but compatible tradition with rationalism, science, and progress, against the claims of the state that it is ultimately a kind of opium of the people. So their faith is justified through the rhetoric of the state, but ultimately stands in contradiction to it.
This is a very interesting finding. And lastly, in your opinion, what kinds of potential development of Sino-Tibetan Buddhism might be possible for us to see in the future?
Yeah, this is quite a difficult question to answer. Yeah, it's very hard to, so many things are happening and changing in China, but I think perhaps we will see more examples of Tibetan masters adapting Tibetan Buddhism to Chinese culture, as we have seen in the case of the reincorporation of Guangdong into the Kamakaju school by the 17th Kamapa. At the same time, I think there's likely to be ongoing tension between the Tibetan religious elite and state efforts to impose their own Sinified understanding of Tibetan Buddhism, as Powers has explored in his book on how the state is seeking to authenticate certain, for example, Chinese Buddhist apocryphal works within Tibetan Buddhism, which is largely rejected by Tibetan monastics. So that is, I think, the origin of the adaptation of Tibetan Buddhism to the Chinese world and the nature of the adaptation are likely to be important to both the Tibetan religious elite and Chinese followers of Tibetan Buddhism. So I think there may be further state-led attempts to flatten out the differences between Chinese and Tibetan Buddhism. At the same time, I think the influence of the Tibetan tradition in Chinese societies is likely to grow. So while there no doubt will be ongoing adaptations, I think the unique guru-disciple relationships between Tibetan root lamas and their Chinese disciples will likely be key to the surviving authentic teachings of Tibetan Buddhism that is perceived to have been passed down in unbroken lineages since the time of the Buddha. The website of the Larunga Buddhist Institute in Sichuan is largely maintained by Chinese disciples who help to disseminate the teachings of their Tibetan masters with whom they have this close relationship. So Chinese all over China are able to access these teachings in their own language and read the hagiographies of these Tibetan teachers. So as long as these centers of Tibetan spiritual power remain, I think maybe there'll be further growth and influence of Tibetan Buddhism in Chinese societies. If you look in Taiwan, already there's a very large following. In Taipei, you can go to just about any block in the city and find a Tibetan Buddhist meditation center. So it has a very large popular following in Taiwan. And the Kamapa is very influential in these developments. So this reincorporation of Guangdong, the ceremony for that was actually televised live on Taiwanese television in 2005. And also Kamakaju monasteries in Taiwan, they are also a mixture of Tibetan and Chinese architectural designs. So I think we'll see more adaptations of the Tibetan tradition to the Chinese world, such as these. But the core teachings are based on the same scriptures and lineages that have been passed down. I think they're likely to continue without major influence from Chinese Buddhist traditions, such as Chan Buddhism, for example. So of course, outside the direct transmission of Tibetan Buddhism to Chinese disciples, there are also many Tibetan influence, new forms of Sino-Tibetan Buddhism initiated mostly by Chinese religious practitioners. So we may see new forms of Sino-Tibetan religion such as these taking root in the future. But I don't expect this to happen really within the strictly Tibetan Buddhist circles or among Chinese followers.
Well, thank you for the expert analysis and, I guess, predictions for the future. I guess we'll have to see what happens. Well, we've actually taken up a lot of your time. We've come to 60 minutes already. So I will ask the final question traditional to our New Books Network. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about the projects that you're currently working on now?
Yeah, so at the moment, I haven't actually got a concrete project I'm working on, but looking at working on maybe the research going forward. So I'd like to look at more research into the Republican era monks who went to Tibet and studied under the Tibetan masters in Lhasa such as Nanhai and Fatsun and other Chinese monks, and who brought back the teachings to China. I think it'd be really interesting to look more at their biographies and also their translations into Chinese of Tibetan Buddhist works. So I'd like to examine the significance also of their autobiographies, their biographies, and their teachings for current Chinese practitioners of Tibetan Buddhism, or alternatively, whether they have kind of fallen into disuse with the current focus on the teachings of Tibetan masters who Chinese now have direct access to. So I think that'd be interesting to look at that kind of continuation of the significance or otherwise of their works from the Republican era. That's not really a concrete project at the moment, but going forward, I'd like to develop that further, yeah.
Well, I think the Sino-Tibetan connection, right, and Buddhist connection is something that's been overlooked for quite a long time. So it's definitely really exciting to hear that you're working on this. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about your really exciting book, a book that's really addressing a lot of issues that haven't been adequately addressed in either Buddhist studies or in Sinology or in Tibetan studies. So this is a really exciting project. So really grateful that you're sharing it with us.
No, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be on your show and to share my work and to give some feedback. Thank you.
Great. Well, until next time. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.